Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about what's happening in the world right now and what we think is going to be happening in the world in the near future, and we're not afraid to take a kind of a contrarian view about that. We believe that we're heading for a potentially very bright future, and we believe that if you're not excited about what's happening in the world and where the world is going, that you're just not paying attention. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me, as always in the virtual studio, is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm a little intimidated by our program this evening.
Man, it was your idea. I'm gonna put it all on you.
Okay, let's get that on the record immediately, right? Yeah.
We have decided.
Resort to finger pointing, but Phil came up with the "Hey, let's solve all the world's problems" idea. Okay.
In one show.
Well, you know what? If you're going to solve all the world's problems, don't dilly dally. That's my thinking. Take an hour, get them solved, and then go on to, you know, something else productive to do.
That's right. I can just hear somebody that's, you know, like a critic of the show, you know, some imaginary critic of the show saying, how arrogant are these guys, you know, if they think they're going to solve the world's problems tonight. Well, you know, it's sort of reverse arrogance to think that the problems can't be solved, you know. I mean, we're living in a world now that would be unimaginable to people who came before us, you know. And so why not believe that the problems that we have now can be solved? And which attitude is more helpful, you know? The attitude that says we can't do it, or the one that says that maybe we can. And so
maybe we can solve these problems. And besides, even if our solutions come up less than completely thorough and end up being implemented in all cases, the important thing about this exercise is that we're talking about it, that we're saying, hey, you know what? Let's take a look at these issues and let's see what could be done about them. So we stimulate some thinking, and hopefully we stimulate some thinking amongst ourselves and amongst our listeners and amongst those who choose to call in, if anyone does, and of course those who participate in the chat room. Speaking of which, we've also got Michael Darling with us this evening. Michael, how are you?
I'm on top of the world, gentlemen. Good evening.
We ought to do a shout out to Harvey and Matt. They're in the chat room with you there, Michael. And we expect these guys are going to have to contribute too if we're going to solve the world's problems in an hour.
Yeah, Matt, Harvey, come on, guys, step up. Okay, if we're going to solve the world's problems in an hour, we need everybody's participation. And anyone else who's listening, get in the chat room or give us a call, because we're gonna need some help. So I'm going to back up and talk a little bit about what we mean by all this for anyone who's listening who hasn't read the description or wonders what we mean. But before I do that, I just want to do a quick greatest movie summer in 23 years. Is that right? 26 years?
Ooh, what was it? 81? I think it was 81 was the great summer before. But yeah, in all these years, this is the greatest one since then, yeah.
Check in. Went to see The X-Files, I Want to Believe, yesterday.
Oh, that came out this weekend? I didn't realize that was out.
Yeah.
I was too busy taking the kids to Space Chimps. But
I saw the poster for Space Chimps. How was that?
Well, I'm sorry to get off the X-Files subject, but Space Chimps was cute. It was a kids movie in the truest sense of the word, unlike say WALL-E, which was, you know, the perfect movie for everybody. Space Chimps was seriously a kids movie, and nodded off at once in the movie, but lots and lots of chimp puns. If you have a low tolerance for puns, then steer clear. But it was cute,
right? Or if you don't have a small child who needs to go see this, you might just want to skip Space.
Yeah, that's right. It's one that can definitely wait until you have a small child present. But tell us about X-Files. Was it any good?
Well, I'm gonna go on the record saying that I think that two-thirds of the members and three-quarters of the critics on Rotten Tomatoes are wrong, and that X-Files, I want to believe, is actually a very good movie.
Good.
I always liked that show. It suffers from a couple things. It suffers from being I think it suffers from two different sets of expectations that are causing people to say they don't like it. I mean, you know, I'm not going to argue with somebody's aesthetic experience. They don't like the movie, fine. But I think it's you know, it's this very low key deadpan X-Files type thing. If you remember the TV show,
yeah,
how that worked. Well, that's what the movie's like. That's what the first movie was like, and that's what this one is like. And if you've just watched The Dark Knight and then you watch this, it's an awfully different approach to storytelling, you know.
Well, if you want somebody that's you know, an exciting person to watch, you better go get somebody other than David Duchovny.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't mean that so much even as a diss, but he just plays the character a deadpan very well. That's what he does.
Both are deadpans, and then he makes the occasional wry joke, and you get a little chuckle out of it. He's not a big flamboyant character, and obviously Scully's the same way, even less on the humor side, right? She's just this very serious, very deadpan person.
This is a show about bureaucrats, you know, and the paranormal, and the reason it works is because they're so dry and so bureaucratic and meeting up with this weird stuff, you know.
Right. So, well, I don't want to give too much away, but to say they're bureaucrats is not entirely correct.
Okay.
So at this point in their lives, it does pick the story up a few years later, and some things have changed.
Okay.
And I liked what they did. If you watch the X-Files series all the way through, you know that things had changed radically in their lives anyway. And now things have kind of come into more of a, you would think, well, okay, eventually things have to calm down and they have to be leading more or less normal lives. And so Scully's got her life and Mulder's got his life, and they're not doing what they were doing before exactly. But of course they get dragged into this murder case. And the other set of expectations, in addition to the fact that it's very different from a movie like The Dark Knight, is if you were a fan of the show, you know, there were two kinds of X-Files episodes. There were the episodes that followed the whole myth arc of the show, right? And then there were the filler episodes that we called the MOWs, the Monster of the Week.
Right, right.
Now, this movie is an MOW, okay?
Okay.
It's not unlike
the first movie. The first movie was trying to deal with the mythology and really trying to settle the whole thing, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. The first movie gets you to a place where later in the series they tell us that everything will be resolved in the year 2012, which I think we talked about on the program a couple weeks ago. So I think that there should be a third X-Files movie coming up here in about 3.5 years. That will be back on the myth arc and that will once and for all, I think, end the world. I don't know, or maybe Mulder and Scully will prevent the world from ending. But this was not that. This had nothing to do with UFOs. It had nothing to do with government conspiracies. And so I think if people were going in expecting all that, they might have been taken a little askance because they either weren't expecting or didn't know or had forgotten that, you know, a lot of great X-Files episodes had to do with, like, Chupacabra, or remember the fluke?
There was a couple episodes involving just random vampires and things like that, you know? I mean,
exactly. The guy who was like half man, half fluke, he's like swimming through the sewers and coming out and eating.
Yeah, that was fun stuff, too. I mean, those could be just as fun as the mythology episodes. Although, I always felt like, you know, at the end of a Monster of the Week episode, if only they would have thrown me a little bit of a bone on the myth, you know? And sometimes they did. In the middle of a Monster of the Week episode, you might get some little hint of something. But anyway, yeah, that's
okay. That's, well, they don't completely leave everything out. So you do have a couple references to the overarching arc of the story, but not much.
Okay,
not much. So
okay,
so anyway, well, I think it stands as its own as a fun thriller, and you know, I've got kind of a Jones for Gillian Anderson, so the whole thing just worked for me in a big way. So.
Well, many of us do, Phil. So don't feel alone in that.
Yeah, she's quite an actress.
Yeah.
So let's jump, and unless we have other movie topics.
No, that's it. That's it. Space Chimps covered me this week.
Fair enough. Well, let's jump right into solving the world's problems the Speculist way. And let me give you the background on this. two things actually inspired me to introduce this topic tonight, and X-Files was not one of them. One of them was I was rereading this old business self-help book, a book called The Magic of Thinking Big by David Schwartz, and he's talking about exercises that he used to do with groups to get them thinking creatively about solving problems. And he would give them this challenge. He would say, explain how all jails could be eliminated in the next 25 years. And so you'd have these groups, and people would invariably start throwing out, well, they couldn't. You know, crime is not going anywhere, and we'll probably need more jails. And you'd get all the reasons why that would be impossible, why it's a bad idea, why he's crazy. But he would insist, and he would say, no, assume it's possible. Assume it's possible. How could we do it? How could we eliminate jails in 25 years? And I guess over the years, this David Schwartz collected a really nice list of very creative ideas for how we might eliminate jails in the near future. I don't think any of them have been implemented yet, but it goes to show that even things that seem outrageous and preposterous, if we get to thinking about it, there probably are solutions. Will they be implemented? Well, we need to create a world where those solutions do get implemented. But let's not be afraid of taking on big problems and putting some creative thought around what might be a better approach to solving these than has been tried in the past. So that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to spend a show talking about how in our lifetimes we could, and here's the list I came up with, we can edit this if we need to, eliminate crime, abolish hunger and poverty, end terrorism, eradicate cancer, heart disease, AIDS, or the big killer. Actually, Michael had pointed this one out a while back, is actually diarrhea. Dysentery is the thing that kills more people than anything else. End war, and make the environment pristine. So I think that's a pretty good list of the major problems facing humanity. Would you agree? Did I miss anything on that list?
Aging.
Okay. We could include that as maybe that's the big killer, right?
Yeah, that
the
kills
big killers. Dysentery and aging. Those are the two things that that wipe people out, right?
Right. And it doesn't help if you've got both. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah. Exactly. Well, you want to start with crime, or what do you want to? How do you want to start, Phil?
We can jump into this any which way you want to. As we noted, we were talking amongst ourselves before the program. We've really gotten in over our heads with this. We're going to have some fun, I think, talking about this, and we're really counting on listeners to come through both with comments in the chat room, and if anyone wants to give us a call, you can call us at 347-215-8972 for your own out of the box solutions for these problems. But yeah, let's start with crime, because I've got various thoughts on that one, and we'll see if it stimulates some thinking with you guys. First off, what would you say? What is the current solution to crime? What are the remedies that we currently use?
Well, we lock people up, and that's really it. I mean, when somebody's convicted of a crime, they get locked up generally. If it's a serious crime, and how long they stay in jail often depends on how serious the crime is viewed to be, and so
sure.
that's the big deal.
Yeah, we on the prevention side, I would add that we have locks and lights and alarm systems and security systems of various kinds to prevent crime from occurring.
Right.
And police scattered around and things like that, and then on the once it occurs side, yeah, we lock people up, we put them in jail, and then they're off the streets, and they won't commit crimes until they get back on the streets. But hopefully the idea used to be that people once in prison would be rehabilitated, and then when they came out, they would lead productive lives. I don't know how much of the correctional system in most states even adheres to that idea anymore. My dad worked in corrections back in the 70s, and they at least gave lip service to that at that time. I really don't know.
Yeah, I think now the idea is, well, they won't commit crimes while they're in jail. They may commit crimes to each other, but they won't harm society as a whole if they're all locked away. And so, I don't even think they even try to rehabilitate anymore.
Okay, so those are the in-the-box solutions to crime.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to pose an out-of-the-box solution.
Well, before you do, Phil, can I something that a lot of people don't realize is in the 90s, crime fell off precipitously. I mean, just violent crime particularly. It went down like 53% in most areas. Then we're talking murder, rape, you know, the big ones, okay?
Yes.
And there is a theory, and I've read a paper on it, and it's pretty compelling to me, that the reason is not that we all of a sudden got really good at, you know, scaring people straight or rehabilitation or anything like that, or that our families got stronger or some reason like that. Instead, it was switching from leaded gasoline to unleaded gasoline in the 70s. And urban children no longer. Yes, absolutely. Urban children no longer being exposed to that much lead. During their formative years, when they hit the years that they age say 17 to 25, those years that the people tend to be to commit more crimes. They had not been exposed to lead as children, therefore they were not as prone to be criminal.
That is fascinating. I've never heard that before.
Absolutely.
If you've read the book Freakonomics, there's a completely different take on some related statistics that would say, they never talked about unleaded gas. That's really interesting. Their take in that book is that the correlation is between the passing of Roe versus Wade, and once abortion on demand became available, the cohort within the generation coming up that was most likely to become criminal was never born.
Yeah.
And the crime rate fell because they were not here with us to commit the crimes because their mothers had abortions along the way, which is this very problematic conclusion to come to. And they write about it in the book that this is not to suggest, well, that's a great idea, so therefore abortion was the solution to crime. That kind of social engineering would be the means of preventing people from becoming criminals and solving our crime problem. I think that there's probably some truth to both of those. I think the unleaded gasoline is really interesting. So people exposed to lead were just more prone to.
Lead gives you brain damage, and
right.
the more if it knocks just a few points off your IQ, and apparently it lead is particularly prone to making to damaging your brains in ways that make you violent. There are a lot of people that have brain damage in one form or another that are just the nicest people ever,
mm-hmm.
But for something about lead. People that have their brains damaged by lead, it makes people violent. And so the idea is that removing lead from the environment, and the biggest thing we did to remove lead from the environment is move from leaded gasoline to unleaded gasoline in the mid-70s to the 80s. I think it was like 81, 82, all leaded gas was gone. And so
interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's probably something there. I think that probably abortion on demand probably did have an effect. But I got to thinking about that one, and I came up with an idea that I don't like.
Okay.
But I think it starts to push us in a direction that would be better. Certainly, if you take the Freakonomics solution, and they don't pose it as a solution, and they don't say that's therefore it's a good thing that Roe versus Wade got passed so that we can get rid of all those criminals. But if you take that as a given, okay, you say, all right, well that really worked. By that generation, by the women most likely to produce criminals not having children, you cut crime substantially. What if you did that in a more positive way? The first more positive way I can think of to do that would be to say, well, you know what? We know we're spending a certain amount of money every year to incarcerate criminals, and we spend an awful lot of money prosecuting them. We spend an awful lot of money tracking them down, chasing them down. So if you were to direct efforts at the generation producing the criminals, rather than telling them go have an abortion, what if you said on a very negative scale, we will pay you whatever it is, a fifth of whatever it costs to incarcerate somebody for a year, which I think is a couple $100,000, some fraction of it, 25%, for every year you don't get pregnant, right? You just demographically take the women who are most likely to produce criminals, and you give them that check. Now, this is the idea I don't like, but how effective do you think that would be?
Well, I understand the reason you don't like it. I mean, you talk about an outcry. you would be asking probably certain minority groups to stop having children. How would that go over?
People and blacks and Hispanics disproportionately to the rest of the population not to have kids.
Yeah.
So from an implementation standpoint, I don't like it. And consider
the history of things like the Tuskegee experiments and from the point of view of someone who's black who thinks now the government's paying us not to have children, the conspiracy theories that have already been passed around in black communities, things like, they're sterilizing us with KFC chicken and things like that, So, yeah, that's just not going to work.
I don't think it would work. I think it's a bad idea. How effective would it be, though?
Not very.
Maybe we went fascist tomorrow and we could implement something like that and thought it was a good idea to implement something.
I don't think it would work either. I think that people
I think the problem with that is, and the problem with the abortion theory is that it seems to me that if a criminal's not born in house A, he's going to be born next door. You know, I mean, it's not just that a particular mother is likely to produce a criminal. It can't be that simple. But it does seem like if you don't go that step of saying, okay, therefore we're going to pay women not to have children, which I think would be abhorrent and bad public policy and just a bad idea from the get-go. But if you said, well, let's invest that money that we were going to spend on incarcerating and et cetera, and we'll put that into very specific pointed educational programs.
This is Harvey. Harvey has come up in the chat room with something like this. Harvey is saying in the chat room, education is the best birth control. Put lots of money into educational opportunities. But which educational opportunities are you talking about, Phil?
Well, I'm talking about things that are targeted to help these women who have been identified as the ones who are producing children who are at risk to end up in jail, right, which is a bad thing that we don't want to have happen, to help them develop economically, to help their kids develop economically. I think it would be kind of like Head Start on steroids. I mean, that was really kind of the thinking behind Head Start, wasn't it?
Right, exactly. I don't know how useful Head Start has been. I've not seen any numbers on it, whether it's been good or completely ineffective. I don't know. But I guess we
Harvey
should
says look. In areas of the world where women get education, the birth rate comes down. So maybe just seeing to it that the demographic that is the most likely to produce criminals, that education become available to them and that they're encouraged, motivated, and given incentives to become educated, you might make a huge difference.
Some sort of GI Bill without having to be a GI.
Exactly.
Maybe a Peace Corps bill. You serve in some way. It doesn't have to be that you join the military, but you serve in some way, and in exchange for that, we pay for your education, which in turn pays us back even more. So, I like that.
And I want to point out that I'm not talking about a huge new government spending program. I'm talking about redirecting money that we would have spent later on incarceration.
Right.
We're spending the money more effectively. That's my idea. And Harvey points out that Head Start prevents crime, really. And I had seen stats to that effect too. Okay, so I think a positive educational type program is probably a better on the sociological preventing crime from occurring, and then on the actual interdiction, keeping crime from happening, kind of at the point of sale, at the point of crime. We have to look at improvements in surveillance technology, and I think artificial intelligence, robotics. I really think that robots are probably a big part of the eventual solution to crime. I think that we'll have less crime in the future because it will just be that much harder to get away with it because the walls literally will have eyes. And there's all kinds of issues around loss of privacy that are connected with that. But
and you won't have to have a human. You won't have to have a human monitoring every video camera at all times. If you've got some sufficiently advanced AI, it'll see if something's up and alert the right person.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you address the social causes on one end. You put some really good interdiction technology on the other end, and I would say within our lifetimes we could have crime, if not completely eliminated, down to a tiny, tiny fraction of what it is now.
Wonderful thing. Okay.
My solution to crime.
All right. All right. I've got nothing that can compete with that. Michael, what you got?
Well, first, I crashed in the chat, so I've been blind to the chat. So thanks for recognizing that Harvey and Matt both were had ideas there. Matt had pointed out that surveillance as a way to at least decrease crime, maybe not eliminate, certainly helps. And I think I replied that, as people, we make better choices when we're socially better choices when we're in a social situation. And if you think no one's looking, you're not in a social situation. So I got nothing else. The problem with crime is that at the end of the day, if people have choice, the ability to make choices, sometimes you're going to choose poorly.
Yeah.
That's a good point. I mean,
I could imagine a completely totalitarian system where crime is virtually eliminated, but, you know, I guess it depends to some extent. Well, how do you define crime? And some behavior may be outside of mainstream behavior and still not be criminal because maybe it's not hurting anybody.
Right. And nothing we've discussed will do anything about white collar crime.
Right.
Nothing we've discussed is going to stop.
Well, surveillance could surveillance could help with white collar crime as well.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Might be computer surveillance, but anyway. Network surveillance, but anyway.
But you know what I mean. We're not going to introduce a big Head Start type program in the suburbs to make sure that that your MBA doesn't grow up to be an embezzler. I don't think.
Well,
it would be on the interdiction side, not on the prevention side.
Well, embezzling has a totally different impact on society than somebody being shot and killed. You know.
Exactly. So I guess we were talking violent crime.
Right. Okay. Okay. And
all right, looks like
back
Michael's back in the chat room.
Okay,
so
good.
Life is good. We're moving on. We're having some fun talking about quick solutions to all the world's problems. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil Steven talking about solving problems. If you'd like to join us, come on into the chat room and help solve problems or give us a call at 347-215-8972. You know what I failed to mention, Steven, is the big prize.
Oh yeah. Okay, the person who contributes the most are the best. Either in the chat.
Let's go with the single best idea. Best idea.
All right. Either in the text chat or by calling in, then they get a prize. What is that prize, Phil?
That prize will be an exclusive, first ever mint edition Fast Forward Radio coffee mug. And of course, when I say coffee, you can put hot chocolate, herbal tea, whatever you like, but it's shaped like a coffee mug and it's got the Fast Forward Radio logo on it.
Of course, if you're American like I am, it'll be coffee. But
well, it'll certainly be coffee in my case. But I want our listeners to know that whoever wins this prize will be getting one of these before Michael, Stephen, or I even had one. You will be the first person ever to get a Fast Forward Radio.
And Phil, that's all it took. We've got a caller.
All right.
Hello, welcome to Fast Forward Radio.
Hello.
Who's calling?
This is Harvey.
Hey, Harvey, how are you?
Harvey,
hey.
Welcome to the program.
Well, I was thinking about water desalination technology and solar technology, and I thought that once there were huge water desalination plants, water would change the world, and that would be the most dramatic, positive technological development of the not-too-distant future.
Well, Harvey,
I love where you're going with this, Harvey, but you're going to have to address it to a particular problem. Which one?
Well, here's the particular problem. I'm going to address it for him. Okay, Phil.
Okay. All right.
The very next thing we're going to talk about is abolishing hunger and poverty. And a big part of hunger, of course, is you know, agriculture and why isn't there enough food in the world? Well, perhaps because in part we don't have enough fresh water to for agriculture. And if we have a limitless amount of water available with the huge desalination plants, you can turn the deserts green and feed the world. I think that's great.
Harvey, was that your thinking? Solve hunger and poverty?
Yeah, I was thinking that that would touch on several of the categories, and definitely the environment as well. You know,
right?
If those were solar powered, that wouldn't create any dangerous waste. You know, I suppose depending on battery technology, and but yeah, I just thought water would change the world. Maybe end hunger and some poverty, and have an effect on crime then, and wind up touching a lot of the different categories.
You know, Harvey, if we're turning the deserts green, what are those plants doing? They're sequestering carbon, right? And so that helps the environment. And of course, you've mentioned the hunger.
Oh, that's right. We'll pull CO2 out of the atmosphere because we've created green surface on the planet. We'll terraform portions of Earth, in effect.
Exactly.
Maybe.
You say solar, Harvey. I would say that it's more likely to get the power you need to run huge desalinization plants, it's more likely that you're going to go nuclear, and they're already doing that in some places. And I need to pull. I'll have an article in the show notes about some of these joint projects of having nuclear power plants right next to a desalinization plant where they're producing fresh water out of the ocean and. So, anyway, but yeah, that's and you're not producing a lot of CO2 with a nuclear power plant, that's for sure.
So you had something else you wanted to say, Harv?
No, that's it.
That's a biggie, though. Thanks,
Harv. I think it's a great idea. I think you can fix the environment. You can potentially solve hunger, solve poverty. One thing I was going to say, Stephen, you know, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. A couple months ago, actually, at this point, we talked about these crops that have been genetically engineered to require less water. And this is another approach to the same problem, right? It's like, well, you can genetically engineer the crops so they'll grow in a drier climate, or you can just take seawater, make it potable, make it so the plants can live on it, and you're growing food. I think either way, you've got a great idea. Thanks for that suggestion, Harvey. And you are now in the lead. Okay, for the Fast Forward Radio coffee mug. So.
That's right. So, Matt, you're going to need to step up, bud.
time to step up. Okay, so let's move on. Was that our next one? Which one do you want to tackle next there?
Well, the next one was going to be abolish hunger and poverty, and that's a pretty good one. We've talked recently, in the last couple of weeks, about vertical farms in the cities, taking an old skyscraper that's sitting empty or something and turn it into a giant greenhouse so that you don't have to transport food in. You're not, you're growing, you know, enough food for a lot of people. And, you know, the idea is it'll be completely organic because it's enclosed. You're not going to have a problem with insects and disease and things. You grow it right there inside that tower and it's available right there. You can even have like a farmer's market right there within the first couple of floors of the building. So, it's a great idea, and I think that would work well also with a desalinization plant. Imagine a nuclear power plant right next to a desalinization plant that's funneling water straight to a skyscraper tower, growing food for the city right there within the city.
Sure. Yeah. Or I would think if you had some way of distributing it, a solar approach like Harvey is talking about would probably be pretty effective too, since the ocean is so huge. There's probably some good way to capture the heat that is naturally landing on the ocean and somehow use that to convert it to fresh water. Although I'm not completely sure what that would be, but those are both great ideas, and I do love the idea of what we talked about a few weeks ago was just take all the abandoned buildings in the New York area, turn them into these vertical farms, find power for them, which would be the nuclear or the solar or what have you, and you suddenly you've got enough food for all of New York City. It's an amazing thought. Well, that's hunger. Now, what are we going to do about poverty?
Okay, poverty. I mean, it's the problem with poverty is that you know it's not evenly distributed. You know, I mean, it's not like you can look at the entire world and say, okay, there's this many poor people and this many rich people in the world, and then there's no place in the entire world, though, that you can go, okay, it's evenly distributed. You got this number of rich people, and then right next door there's this number of poor people. It doesn't work that way. And so, poor places in the world tend to stay poor because they don't have access to the networks that the rich people are plugged into, getting richer and richer, whereas the poor people are isolated and are not plugged in. And so I guess globalization is as much as it's been demonized by many people, I think it's probably the best answer to world poverty. Plug more people into the networks and allow them the opportunities to compete in the workplace that rich countries have always had.
Well, I think if you look at the last 20 years, 30 years of human history, the case has been made, and I think it's probably true, that more people have been lifted out of poverty over that period of time than at any other time in human history. And you have to look at that and go, in the People's Republic of China alone, people are leaving poverty at an absolutely unprecedented rate in human history. It's something similar, not quite as dramatic, but similar, happening in India.
Right.
And you say, okay, what are the causes of this? What is lifting people out of poverty? We would like to think that some big organized plan is doing it, and we could say, okay, well, we've done something, so let's do more of that. But it seems to be a combination of technology and free markets. Those seem to be, if you're really going to honestly say, what is it that's pulling people out of poverty? It's those two things working together that make that possible. And
that's an anathema to some people. So, you know, if it's some people just don't like to hear that, but it's, you know, evil capitalism is what is helping more people than anything else. And
well, I don't know about evil, but apparently capitalism is, and it's one of those kind of paradoxes, because what we want to think, what we're inclined to think, and what I grew up believing, is that the best solution to poverty would surely be some kind of vast redistributionist system, you know, where you say, okay, well, these, you know, what you were talking about before, some people seem to be rich, others seem to be poor, let's do the Robin Hood thing, let's iron it out, and everybody will be okay.
That kind of program is appropriate, I think, to deal with a short-term crisis. If you've got millions of people starving to death in the Sudan or someplace, and then ship them some food. But, you know, but ultimately, it's a whole lot better to teach a person to fish than to give them a fish. You know,
well, yeah. I mean, that's the old saying, and it appears to be a true old saying. It appears that, I mean, what did China do? Well, they said, we're going with the old. It's glorious to become wealthy. We're throwing off most of our controls on free enterprise. We're allowing people to start their own businesses. We're allowing people to own private property. We're allowing them to use technology in ways that they haven't been able to, and you know, you see 6, 7, 8, 9, 10% growth every year for what now? 15 years anyway, probably, in the People's Republic of China. Unprecedented, again, in world history, and I think a real signpost to what can work. I think you give people choices, and you give people opportunities, and they and they can lift themselves out of poverty better than other people can lift them out of it. And I think that's probably what most people want. What most people want is an opportunity to have their own livelihood, to you know, own some property, or to, you know, have something that a good job or a piece of a business, but something that's their own, something that they can creatively engage with or that they can engage with every day and, you know, direct their own life.
Right.
Because I think it's not just economic freedom. I think it's personal individual liberty that also comes into play. And that's the other thing that probably has, although some would argue not to the extent that it should have, but, you know, you can quibble about those things. That's the other thing that has the genie that's kind of been let out of the bottle in China over the same period of time, is people are much freer there than they were under, say, you know, Mao during the Cultural Revolution. So if you set people free and you set markets free, it looks like that does a lot towards lifting people out of poverty. Will technological development and free markets on their own lift everybody out of poverty around the world? I don't think so. I think that it would be nice to think that's the case, but I don't think that's the case. I think that...
Well, here's why I would disagree, Phil, because...
Okay.
It won't be us that are lifting people out of this, you know, by plugging them in. To a large extent, it's these people that are reaching out and grabbing the opportunities that come to them, and they're not gonna, they don't necessarily remake, you know, their poor country into a suburb of Denver. You know, they become, you know, they become whatever it is that they choose to become. And so I guess it's just another way of saying that throughout the world, the world is not going to become homogenous just because perhaps, you know, more of the world becomes developed. And I don't know if I'm necessarily addressing the problem I had with what you just said, Phil. But
well, that's okay. I think you're right. And I don't think that striving for a homogenous world is even a good idea.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that what's great about allowing individual liberty, individual initiative, to come into play is that all around the world, people will find different approaches and different solutions. And
speaking of different solutions, Michael is talking about something in the chat room. Michael, one thing that may happen that you mentioned a couple times here in the chat is that you may not see the same sort of industrial factories and things in some places of the world that you that you see in the United States. They might do it a different way. They might have fab labs. That do, and they make their own things in a much smaller scale, but for maybe just their community. And I'm not hearing Michael. Have we lost
Michael
again?
Can hear us?
Okay.
We've lost him again.
Okay. Well, Michael, call back in. Yeah.
Yeah. Call back when you get a chance. But you might want to do that trick you did.
Yeah, I just did it.
Oh, okay. The crosstalk on the professionally produced radio program. I think the thing is that just as food distribution, if it's done locally, you know, we talk about think of how much you save if all that food for New York City was produced right there in New York City. Or anyway, everybody knows that it makes sense if you go to the supermarket and it says, you know, these cantaloupes were locally grown, that you're saving, that's good for the environment, right? And it's good for your local economy. It's just a good thing if things are produced as close to home as possible. That's one of the kind of trends people have been working towards over the last few years. Well, what if it's
Michael,
not...
Michael, did you have a contribution to make on that Fab Lab stuff?
No, you pretty much got it. I think, you know, bigger picture, the poverty as a question becomes a grammatical definitional thing, and it becomes a disparity thing, because I don't know, I suppose in 100 years somebody could look at my lifestyle today and say, oh, that guy's in poverty. But if I look at somebody that was living 100 years ago aspiring to the lifestyle that I live today, it would have been like you'd have to be Nelson Rockefeller. You know, you just couldn't picture how attainable this level is. So if you ignore the disparity and just say, well, poverty is really all about food and health and subsistence, at an existence level. That's where the Fab Labs, that's where food's always a problem in some areas. It's not a problem everywhere. And where food is not a problem, people don't starve. And where it is a problem, it's a distribution issue. But for the rest of the, quote, material wealth, Fab Labs and electricity, of course.
So I guess the keys to eliminating poverty in places like out-of-the-way places of the world would be education again, creating situations where they can make their own food, and Harvey's idea of having plenty of water available so that they can grow their own food and things like that.
Well, but then you give them a Fab Lab, and they're going to build themselves a solar collector. They're going to build themselves a laptop. They're going to get on the Internet. And, they're going to start some kind of business on the Internet or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and the second they do it, they're going to realize that somebody else has a better Fab Lab than they do, and they're going to feel poor again.
Well, again, it's not about, maybe that's a good thing that somebody feels poor again, and then they strive harder, and then they go out and make more money. But if you solve the basic problems of, okay, they've got, they got enough to eat. They've got enough they got enough water. They're going to make it. Then after that, the opportunities to do much better than would make they would have those opportunities. But if you're starving, you're not going to be able to plug in to a global economy. It just doesn't happen if your basic needs have not been met.
This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil, Stephen, and Michael, we're talking about solving all the world's problems. There is a Fast Forward Radio coffee mug, limited collector's edition, in play. And if you'd like to compete for that, give us your thoughts on how to solve these problems. Either join us in the chat room or give us a call at 347-215-8972. Well, I can see by the way the hour is passing that I'm going to officially now declare this the first of two parts, which I probably should have said. So we'll do some of these topics tonight, and maybe we'll pick this up again next week, too. I don't think we're going to solve all the world's problems in one night. That's unrealistic. We'll do it over a two-week period.
Because that's much more realistic.
Yeah, I think that's a lot more realistic. Finally, okay, reality has caught up with us. So let's something I want to say about hunger. This is one – something you encounter around hunger and poverty that I don't think you necessarily encounter with other problems. I mean, people tend to take a kind of negative and fatalistic view towards all of these. But with hunger and poverty, at least within a Christian culture, they also throw this one at you. Have you ever heard this one? Well, Jesus said, the poor you always have with you.
That's right there in the Bible. But the thing is, I don't think that that's meant to say that you shouldn't try to address poverty.
Well, I don't either. I think that's crazy. I think it wasn't a commandment,
right?
It was an observation, and B, it was like if Jesus had said, you can't walk through a river without getting your feet wet, we'd say, okay. Don't build insulated boots. Right?
Yeah,
I mean, Jesus observed a problem, therefore,
therefore we shouldn't even try to do anything about the problem. Yeah, that doesn't make any sense, does it?
Yeah, I think that word always has become an excuse, and people say, "Well, we're not going to do anything in poverty." I mean, Jesus said, and I think that's nothing but an excuse. And I think
it's sort of an anti-Christian excuse. I mean, if there's anything that can be, charity has always been a central tenet of the religion, and
exactly right.
And so it's a bit anti-Christian to try to use that to say let's not even try to help poor people. So
anyway, I didn't think it was likely to come up tonight, but it's a pet peeve, so I thought I would throw that one out there. Okay, let's move on to I think the third and final of the world's problems that we're going to solve this evening. And that would be should we do terrorism or do you want to?
Yeah, let's do terrorism. Let's jump in on.
Okay,
terrorism.
We're going to do terrorism, and this is where I'm going to give another shout out to Harvey because I said I had two inspirations for the program tonight. One was David Schwartz's book, and the other was not the most recent now because he's cranking them out so fast. But the second most recent video that Harvey put up, he actually all of his most recent videos, as all of his videos, are excellent. But he's got one on the Maslow Hierarchy of Needs that everyone needs to watch. So I think we're going to have to put that one up there because
that's one of my favorite subjects too. I keep trying to find a way to talk about Maslow's Hierarchy of Needs at the Speculus, and I just never can find the right way to present it. But anyway, so I'll have to.
Well,
watch
okay,
that.
Look at how Harvey presents it. I think it's about as straightforward as you're ever going to see anybody present this subject. So check that out. And then his next discussion was on. What do we do about terrorism? And he had two ideas that he threw out. One was that you don't combat it either as a law enforcement problem or a military problem, that you need a solution in between, which I thought was very interesting, very innovative thinking. And the other thing he said was you go to the root cause and you address things we already talked about, poverty and education. That
right.
if people weren't poor and desperate, and if people were properly educated, on the one hand, and if you have this other kind of means of combating it, on the other hand, you start to really eliminate the problem of terrorism. Now, let's go to the interdiction part in a minute. What do you think of Harvey's prevention ideas?
Well, I think that there are occasions
stated
where
stated very briefly by me. He says it better, obviously.
Okay. Okay. I would say that there are times and places for a military solution to the problem of terrorism, and also there are law enforcement solutions, and perhaps there's room also for something in between. But I mean, you know, if you have information on where, you know, the commanders of Al Qaeda are in Afghanistan, and they're staying in a building, well, you can go blow that building up. You know, I mean, that is a good for the world when those guys are taken out, and that's a military operation. So, you know, I wouldn't be ready to say that, you know, that solutions necessarily don't need to be military. I think that there are, you know, the military solutions that have been in place since 9/11. I think are to a great extent the reason why we have not been attacked at that level again. Well, hardly at all since 9/11.
The bad guys are
busy running and hiding rather than planning their next big attack.
Stephen, you went to the interdiction, and I was trying to stay on the root cause.
I know.
That's okay.
I'll let you go back to the root cause.
You're going to be the last one to get a mug. I'm
yeah, that's right. No
you're
doubt that's
way
true.
Down the list.
I wasn't holding out much hope, I must say.
Let's stick with the interdiction piece for a minute, though, because I think it's interesting. And what I took from that was I like the idea of something kind of in between, something kind of lean and mean.
By the way, Michael says he's going to fab his own mug.
Well, if he gets the Fab Lab going, he can make us all one. It will cost us less than what I'm going to have to pay at Cafe Press, so by all means.
No doubt. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
First one goes to Harvey, though. I like the idea of, especially if it's a technology-driven solution, I like the idea of there being something that that doesn't involve putting a lot of boots on the ground where not necessary, not putting a lot of lives at risk. And, you know, outside of the subject of specific wars we're currently involved in, which just open up this huge, you know, can of worms to talk about.
Yeah.
The idea that we could, if we could interdict effectively in a much more targeted way, exactly the way you're talking about, right? I mean, it's like when the satellite tells you where the guy is, you know, and you know he's the guy, right?
Right.
It's like, and you can take him out, and you're not going to take anybody else out. That's the kind of thing we're ultimately shooting for. Literally and figuratively, we want to have a situation where technology is going to make it possible to get much more pinpointed in interdicting with these cases. But I want to go back to the root cause piece. That's where I wanted to start with that. You know, whether addressing poverty, which I would want to do, we've talked about anyway, as an end unto itself, and providing education is sufficient to fighting the problem, and I would say maybe not. And the reason I would say maybe not, I think it depends on what you mean by education. But we have this situation where there's not a one-on-one, one-to-one correspondence between poverty and desperation and acts of terrorism, right? You've got some desperately poor people who don't become terrorists,
right?
And you've got some terrorists who aren't desperately poor. So
yeah, Bin Laden being a great example of that.
Well, Bin Laden is kind of your case in point, right? But even the 9/11 attackers were, by and large, fairly well educated and fairly prosperous, or you know, affluent for the populations they represented. So, although I think that if you take poverty out of the equation, everything does get a lot better. There's no question about that. I'm not sure that you absolutely solve this particular problem, because I think that people commit these acts for reasons other than economics, and that's where the education piece that Harvey was talking about comes in, and I think that that's an important piece. But I think that it goes beyond that probably. I think you get to the point where you have to, what I have described metaphorically as wage an all-out meme war.
Yeah.
Where ultimately people have to be exposed to ideas other than very insular fear of the other kinds of ideas that, and I am not suggesting that chicks dig terrorists. That is absolutely as far from what I'm saying as. Thanks for your contribution there, Michael, but no, that's not what I'm saying.
You don't, no mug for Michael.
He's not getting a mug. He can't even make his own. What I am saying is that that this is a struggle that goes on beyond economics and beyond even rudimentary and fundamental basic education. It goes into a kind of opening up the world. I think if people are given a choice, if you give somebody a choice between, hey, you can have this really insular worldview and view others as the other that have to be destroyed, and you can have a view that says others are interesting and you should interact with them, that people are really going to go for that second choice. I think that throughout history, when they actually have the choice, that's what they pick. And Harvey even says that these new communication technologies can help bring people out of their culture cages, and I think that's true. I think that's what has to happen. You think about what we were trying to do back during the Cold War with Radio Free Europe. I think that the free part of the world has to offer new perspectives and new ideas and new ways of looking at the world to those who otherwise wouldn't have them. And I think that is the piece that, until that happens effectively, you don't get rid of terrorism. But once that does happen effectively and you've addressed those other problems, I think we're on our way.
Saudi Arabia is – I think that the government of Saudi Arabia is in a good position to address terrorism and a better – in some ways and in some instances better position than our own government. They have been promoting for years a certain sect or certain branch of the Muslim faith called, I'm believing we're pronouncing it correctly, Wahhabism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a particularly, it's more prone to produce terrorists than other sects and branches of the Muslim faith. And part of it is that it's used by, the government has been promoting this as a way of blaming, you know, getting the population within Saudi Arabia blaming others for their plight. You know, if they hate Jews and hate, you know, the great Satan, the United States, and everybody else is putting you in this place. It's not us, you know, up at the top robbing the oil and living like, you know, like kings, which is what they are. But you know, it's these other people that are making your life so miserable.
Right.
And so it's performed this function. This particular branch of the Muslim faith has performed this function for the ruling class of Saudi Arabia. Now, if Saudi Arabia ever wants to step into the modern world, then perhaps they can promote a different branch of the Muslim faith, a more peaceful branch, a more cosmopolitan, with a more cosmopolitan outlook on the world. Do so, guys, and it's come step into the modern world and join us. And you don't have to promote terrorism, and you know, and their country could bring the bottom up, and that'd be good for them too. I would suspect that is something that needs to happen, and I'm not sure what we can do in the United States. That's something that people in places like Saudi Arabia are going to have to decide for themselves.
Well, I think that I don't know that it's, you know, I guess I'm not talking at the level of what governments can do, although there's a discussion going on about the Saudis have put forward an Arab peace initiative, which has, you know, at least put it out there that they'd like to see the whole Middle East problem solved, and that they're ready to invest heavily in it. Again, you know, that I think is great. What I'd also like to see is, like, start letting women drive, okay?
small steps, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's like, okay, sure, making overtures to solving peace on a geopolitical standpoint is good, but allowing people to think their own thoughts and to control their own destinies is a huge part of what really needs to happen in order for...
Freedom of religion might be a nice thing to try, that they could think about doing too, you know. Allowing a single Christian church in the country.
Just pick on Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, it's not just Saudi Arabia. It's whole areas of the world that are like that. But it's particularly galling.
Now Matt points out that the Christian counterpart to Wahhabism is Reconstructivist Dominion theology. I think it'd be very informative to detail why this sect is almost extinct. And Harvey points out that some Arab countries have religious freedom. All true.
That is true.
This is not our attempt to bash Arabs, right? That's not what we're about. I think Saudi Arabia, though, in terms of their approach to human liberty, represents just about the antithesis of a lot of the stuff that I think would help to eliminate terrorism in the world. But again, we're not talking just about terrorism as it occurs in the Muslim world. We're talking about what causes it overall. And I think what causes it overall is people having insular views of the world, people not seeing others as people that are one, that they can be in community with, that they can be in relationship with. If you view the other as somebody who has to be despised and destroyed, I think that's where the real terrorist mindset comes from.
Right.
And I want to get back to something that Matt said, because I think he was in the competition here for the mug, and now I have to. We got talking about other stuff, so I didn't. Matt, I want you to follow up on the. Here it is. The concept of costly authentication is useful to the terrorism issue. If a young man who's a possible recruit for a terrorist organization knows for certain that he's giving up a worth. Explain that one a little further.
I think I know where he's going with this. If a man has hope about his life, let's say you're 17 years old, and it looks like you have the opportunity to get a job, marry a beautiful woman, settle down, have a bunch of kids, live a long life, and be happy, then you're not going to become a terrorist. A terrorist is what you become when it doesn't look like there's any opportunities to go get a job. You know, there's not going to be an opportunity to marry. You know, that's the sort of thing you do when that's the case. You know, so I think is that what you were talking about? Okay.
It says it broke up his comment. So.
All right.
And now Stephen is saying chicks dig non-terrorists.
Exactly.
No, Michael, we don't actually allow that word on the program. That's sexist language. We don't talk that way on Fast Forward Radio.
Yeah, we prefer the language skirt, but anyway.
Jeez. No, we don't. All right. Well, I think we're heading into non-productive territory at this point, and we are running a little bit past our time. This has been really, I think, interesting, and I've enjoyed so much the commentary that we've gotten from the chat room tonight and our caller. I think we're going to keep the competition open, though, Harvey. Not to say you won't get the mug, but I think we're going to extend this to next week. So we'll pick it up with war and disease and whatever the other one was. I'm not looking at it right now.
Just
fixing the environment. No big deal.
Yeah.
We'll save that for the last 5 minutes. That's okay. An easy one.
We need Harvey to say what size mug he wants.
Oh, well, not
yet. We have
yet.
Three sizes. Wee, not so wee, and friggin' huge!
Sorry. sorry.
Well, I'm sure he wants frickin' huge. All right, so we're going to wrap this discussion up for tonight. Stephen, this has been extremely fun. What do we got going on music-wise this evening?
James Castro apparently loves his hometown of Alpharetta, Georgia. And so he's written this song, and it's called Awesome Alpharetta.
Awesome Alpharetta. And I think we agreed earlier that if people would just get into their own hometowns a little more, that most of these problems in the world would start to dissipate somewhat, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're going to listen to Awesome Alpharetta. We'll have show notes up with links to some of Harvey's videos and other things we've been talking about sometime tonight, or keep checking back. Stephen will get them up there when he can. Michael, thanks to you and to everyone in the chat room for your contributions.
Yep.
You're welcome.
It's been great. Thanks, Michael.
And we look forward to being with you all again next week when we'll solve the rest of the world's problems on the next Fast Forward Radio. Good night.
South Main Street, city's coming alive. Cafe aromas, hummingbirds humming, and pine trees painting on a clear blue sky. Feel the rhythm on these downtown streets, destination where the best of Georgia meets. Awesome Alpharetta, bringing dreams and people to. Small town where you can lay your hair down.